Union has suspended a debate on whether to withdraw Israel's accreditation. This is happening despite growing calls on the bloc to overturn last year's decision to grant Israel an observer status. Why the controversy? Overall, many African Union member countries consider Israel an apartheid regime. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Israel's intentions behind its desire to be an AU member, especially in the context of so-called normalization.
Israel, once again at the heart of an international rift and controversy, this time within a usually united body valuing consensus, the African Union. A row so fierce that the bloc was forced to suspend a debate on whether to rescind Israel's observer status and postpone a potentially divisive vote. The rare dispute within the 55-member body was set in motion last July. That's when Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, unilaterally accepted Israel's accreditation to the bloc. A slew of criticism followed. Powerful members, including South Africa and Algeria, were among the many protesting that the decision had been taken without consultations. They also argued that the decision flew in the face of African Union statements supporting the Palestinian territories. The AU has called for an end to the Israeli occupation and an independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. Israel received AU observer status after 20 years of diplomatic efforts. The quest is largely seen as part of the regime's US-backed campaign to normalize ties with African and Arab countries, such as Morocco, Sudan, the UAE and Bahrain. But analysts believe the normalization does not enjoy popular support.
Of course, Israel has hitherto been, of course, unaccepted in Asia or in West Asia. And although you've got clandestinely nations like Saudi Arabia who have been dealing with it and others more overtly like Jordan and Egypt, etc., you've nonetheless got this kind of fear amongst leaderships in West Asia, even now, of openly becoming part of the Israeli syndicate, so because the people, ultimately at the grassroots, certainly the Arab people, are not happy with the idea of Israel being accepted.
Palestine gained observer status at the African Union in 2013. Its Prime Minister, Mohamed Shtayyeh, addressed the bloc's latest summit held at the weekend. He called for Israel's accreditation to be revoked.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion. This must stop.
Resistance movement Hamas has also slammed granting Israel the observer status. Hamas says the move is a flagrant violation of the principles and statute of the African Union, which reject racism and demand decolonization and the right to self-determination. The African body has now set up a six-country committee to review Israel's observer status and submit its findings during an assembly next year, a decision that will ultimately come down to whether or not the bloc will stick to its anti-colonial and anti-racist principles.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Spotlight, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, is a journalist and Middle East expert. She joins us from London. Also joining us, Netfa Freeman, Pan-African Community Action, Black Alliance for Peace, joins us from Washington, D.C.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Hafsa Kara Mustafa, let me start with you, and if you can give us a backdrop as to what is going on here, what's the controversy all about? We understand Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chair of the African Union Commission, accepted Israel's defense status in the bloc without consultations, from what we understand. And maybe that is what sort of put the spotlight on this and then create the controversy. But what exactly has happened?
Well, the controversy actually stems from the fact that many peoples across the African continent refuse to recognize or acknowledge the legitimacy of the state of Israel. Obviously, Arab countries are opposed to it in solidarity with the Palestinian people. But of course, the African continent itself has suffered from colonialism and therefore understands the plight of the Palestinian people and is not in solidarity at all with Israel. In general terms, there are obviously pockets here and there where there's been influence from Christian fundamentalists, American Christian fundamentalists across the continent that have influenced various communities to go towards supporting the state of Israel. But in general terms, of course, across the continent, there is consensus that colonialism is wrong, is morally reprehensible. And therefore, because Israel represents the last, in fact, colonial outpost in the region, it has to be opposed. So the controversy stems first from actually taking this decision, second, obviously, unilaterally, but of course, again, because it goes against the Charter of the African Union, which recognizes that before any moves towards normalization with Israel in general terms has to be made on condition that Palestinian rights be respected. And of course, that isn't the case. On the background, of, obviously, to this, there are many issues happening behind the scenes, in particular in the way Israeli companies are actually looking to get a foothold in the numerous sectors of natural resources of countries like, for instance, Congo or Rwanda, hence the move for normalization and for increased presence, Israeli presence, should I say, across the African continent.
Sure. You just went through five of our questions here that I was going to ask, but that's okay. Let's expand on all of them. The one that really struck me, aside from the fact that this observer status was introduced, is the one about the charter. So let me ask you, Netfa Freeman, you have a charter of the African Union that is well known to its member countries, but yet you have the chair of the African Union Commission to have accepted Israel's observer status. This was going to come out anyways, you know, so why did this proceed? Of course, Hafsakar Mustafa gave us some very good reasons, but you give us yours.
Well, I think that this whole thing, you know, the accreditation of Israel to the African Union should have never been considered, and it actually reflects the full-blown subservience of the African Union to neocolonialism. The previous speaker was talking about colonialism, and we have to look at the specific forms of colonialism. The most of the member states, they're not representing the wishes and the sentiments of the masses of the people in their different countries. And so it also reflects the fact that these countries are really not people-centered democracies, and that the Africa used to be the vanguard of global solidarity with Palestinians and against Zionism and settler colonialism. And so the charter is really, you know, like the UN charter and like the US Constitution and all these things are circumvented, are just sidelined by the powers that be in the world. If you look at contradictions, like for the fact that Haiti, actually, you know, pretty much an African country, you know, can't even enjoy or be regarded with accreditation to the African Union, it shows that the charter means very little when it comes to leveling the power of the global dominance that characterizes white supremacy and settler colonialism in the world.
So, Hafsakar Mustafa, we have the fact that you mentioned, and our guest there from Washington, D.C. also mentioned how Israel is shunned by many of the African countries. And I'd like to know the percentage, if you can state that. But I'm sure Israel is aware of that also. So what happened is we had this so-called normalization occur. I'm wondering if the normalization was a prelude to Israel being accepted in return for, I'm not too sure, economic perhaps dividends of some kind coming from Israel. Is that what the African countries were promised in return? Is that how it went down, do you think?
It depends of each different country. In the case of Sudan, for instance, we know that Sudan was going through a major financial crisis, and therefore it was promised financial support from the U.S. in exchange for normalization. We know that other countries, for instance, were Well, if you take the RDC, for instance, which has the largest reserves of copper in the continent and actually across the world, we have various interests. And that's the most important thing, actually, diamond mines in the region. We know, if you take on board the fact that Tel Aviv is the main platform for diamond exchange, then you will know that the relation with Africa, that actually Israel is dependent on African resources, but because African governments are in turmoil in these regions, they're actually having to depend on Western companies, or in this case, Israeli companies, to trade their product. And so there's this sort of unhealthy relationship that has developed between African governments, which are in turmoil, which are very often corrupt, and these countries such as Israel or the US. I mean, it's difficult to differentiate between the two because they obviously both work in the same sense, in terms of destroying African economies, keeping the continent in constant turmoil in order to exploit its natural resources. So when we go back to what the root causes of this desire for normalization, it is to get a hand on African resources, but of course also to increase the normalization, because the more countries normalize with Israel, the more legitimacy Israel feels it has, and therefore feels that its presence is no longer threatened in any way, shape, or form.
So this legitimacy that Hafsa Karamo Safel mentions, Netva Freeman, is something that it needs to be recognized by the African countries. Unfortunately, we know that many African governments, I'm not going to say a lot, but many of them are known to be corrupt. But I'm wondering what kind of pressure may be exerted on the governments to accept Israel into their mainstream, business, so that they can not only reap the rewards off their corruption, but also then have Israel come in, and again, as our guest on London said, to somewhat take advantage of the natural resources, number one being at the top of the list, again, as our guest in London said.
Mm-hmm. Well, we know that the United States has been the biggest supporter of Israel throughout its existence, and gives, you know, lots of financial support to Israel, and that has been behind some of the pressures exerting on some of the countries, like, for example, Sudan was mentioned. And one of the things that alleviates Sudan's, economic issue is that it being on the terrorist list. So that was a promise that was given to the United, that was, a promise or a negotiated thing between primarily the United States and Sudan. So the United States is really behind some of these maneuvers. We also know that a lot of the United Nations resolutions in the General Assembly, Israel doesn't get enough support, largely a lot of times because some of these, despite their corruption, that their resolutions are things are not voted for, the things that would favor Israel. These kind of moves also alleviate the isolation of Israel and Zionism, the exposure of Zionism as an inhumane system. And so these are the kind of things that happen. I think also we can't take Israel out of the global context of, and I would consider desperation of white supremacy and the pan-European project of really trying to hold international dominance, and particularly its competition with other forces in the world, China, Russia. And so it's trying to shore up as much as it can or sway as much as it can its influence, and Israel is a big part of that. A lot of Israel behind the scenes in terms of how the United States dominates the continent of Africa through military arms sales and things like that. A lot of that, Israel's involved in those kind of things. And then, like we say, the international trade through diamonds and those types of things are very important. But we can't underestimate the role that the Western countries, particularly the United States, plays in this scenario.
Sure. Well, as we go through our daily lives, Hafsa Kara Mustafa, Israel is doing a fantastic job of violating the Palestinian rights. And recently, there was a 280-page report that talks about how Israel, in a matter of just summarizing it, is an apartheid regime. So Israel is racking up its report card very well with these types of not only violations, but also reports that come out condemning it to that effect. Doesn't that make it very difficult for organizations like the AU to even consider having Israel come on board?
Well, I think the fact that they've had this latest decision proves that they've realized the massive mistake and are sort of trying to backtrack from it. I think it's a good sign that pressure was exercised on the AU Council to actually rescind the invitation. And so I think that the added pressure coming from Western NGOs can only make the case stronger. I mean, I think it's a bit sad that we'd have to rely on Western NGOs to actually make a case for Palestinian oppression or for the apartheid nature of the Israeli regime. But I think that does go some way in saying that even if countries that are normally friendly towards Israel are now acknowledging that it's a racist entity, that it practices apartheid, that means that there is no excuse for countries who've suffered from apartheid, who've suffered from colonialism, to actually engage in any way with a terrorist entity such as Israel.
Yeah, I'd like to get some reflections here on some people who are well-known within the Israeli community and their account of what apartheid is. And Netva Freeman, let me quote here Yossi Sarid, a former Israeli cabinet minister, ex-leader of the opposition, a member of the Knesset for 32 years, who back in 2008 said, quote, "What acts like apartheid is run like apartheid and harasses like apartheid is not a duck. It is apartheid." And there's been many Israeli, I guess, political figures who have also led a hand in categorizing Israel as an apartheid regime. Ehud Barak, Ehud Olmert, they all talked about it also in those with a similar stance. So if you have Israeli officials labeling Israel itself as an apartheid regime, then that says something, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. It says something. It's really, and the apartheid as a system can be obscured by the normalization of countries like the United States. The United States is an apartheid country. It's a settler colony, but people don't see it that way. But because of the, I think we would call the increasing fascist nature and the untenable situation in Israel as, you know, illegitimate state, then there are those who have to acknowledge, you know, what is done. I don't even, it's hard to even say the increased fascism, because it's really, Israel really has just really existed on this type of you know, behavior or foundation ever since its existence. But at this point, I think the world is waking up to the natures and fundamental nature of Zionism and what it really entails, that it is racism, that it is settler colonialism, which in fact is apartheid in a statutory way. And so, yes, I think it says a lot, but it's also reflective of the increasing illegitimacy, crisis of legitimacy that Israel's facing along with the rest of the Western nations.
Hafsa Kamar Mostafa, the possibilities of what we're looking at in Africa in terms of the U.S. involvement. Our guest talked about it, Netva Freeman. You know, we're witnessing an Africa that's somewhat unstable in the past, over a year now. We've witnessed 7 coups that have happened here. Now, I'm not saying there's a direct relationship between the coups and the U.S., but overall, we have some Western traces in some of these coups. France has been actually, accused of it when it comes to countries like Mali. But what my question is there a possibility that the U.S., and then in turn, maybe by default, Israel, sees opportunities when it comes to instability in certain African countries to try to move in and then have Israel obviously be introduced to these countries?
Well, absolutely. I think turmoil is essential to Western economies, and I don't mean just for the US or Israel. I think for all Western countries, because all countries across the world, in fact, are reliant on African resources. It's not just copper, it's not just gold, it's not just diamond, it's also uranium, it's also a whole plethora of things that exist only on the African continent that are essential for computers, for nuclear technology, for all these things that are only found on the continent. So it is essential to keep African markets going. But of course, in order to keep prices down, the ideal scenario is to have the African countries in constant turmoil. Once they're in constant turmoil, once they're constantly embroiled in civil conflict, in wars, in coups, they can't control the markets, they can't control the prices of the products that they're exporting, and therefore they're reliant completely on Western countries buying at the prices that they deem fit, which is why you will always find a Western imprint on any coup, on any civil conflict that is occurring on Africa. Whether we like it or not, it isn't some sort of conspiracy theory about a foreign hand. There is always a Western hand in any scenario that has taken place in the last 50 years on the continent, precisely to keep the prices of the natural resources down and allow Western markets to exploit African resources.
One of the headlines that I'd like to ask you, Netha Freeman, is the UAE taking steps to gain control of Sudan's main port. Now, there is an intense cooperation and collaboration, I should say, between the UAE and Israel when it comes to Yemen, on the southern side, I guess, Socotra Island, and then that main waterway there. And it is said this collaboration is somewhat the spark to have Israel and the UAE move along African ports and try to, I guess, take control of them, as we can see here. Whether together or whether separately, I'm not sure. This particular headline talks about the UAE doing that. Do you think then that the so-called normalization with Israel would be characterized by these types of actions?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is all in line with trying to shore up Israel's ability and influence as a player on the African continent. I don't want to claim to know enough about this particular issue, so I haven't studied that issue enough. I know that, but obviously it's clear that, you know, the United Arab Emirates and Yemen and what's happening there is supported by the West, and that they want, and it has a lot to do with resources, like the other guest is saying, a lot of it has to do with resources. But I will say this about it, and if I can comment on the last question, I agree with everything our other guest is saying. I would add, though, that when it comes to the coups on the continent of Africa, it's a bit more complicated in the sense that the neocolonialism is becoming untenable by the masses of the people, and you'll see that some of the people are cheering on some of the coups when they take place. So it's not just a matter of the militaries that are trained by French Foreign Legion or AFRICOM or something, but it's also the masses of the people who are actually decrying the neocolonial, the comprador class, and that the military, the emboldened military class, is taking advantage of that. But there's a groundswell, particularly in the French former colonies, against neocolonialism, and that also is a factor that cannot be ignored.
Sure. Habzikar Mustafa, I'm going to ask the same question to you, because I believe that this actually has some depth to it when it comes to the Israeli and the UAE collaboration. It really appears like, as I'm sifting through some of these headlines, that this is a collaboration that is very deep, and that they are citing the fact that together they want to move down into African ports, perhaps. Sudan is one of them that the UAE in particular has gone through. We know UAE has been involved in Africa, for example, in Libya and elsewhere. So the normalization is a good way, just like the Israel becoming an AU, which at this point has been rescinded, I guess observer status membership is rescinded, that the normalization would lead to that. Is that what we're looking at in that context?
Well, absolutely. I mean, you mentioned the islands of Socotra and the south of Yemen. These are major, major trade routes that have been responsible for the prosperity of East Africa, the Arabian Peninsula, and even further up towards India and Iran. So these are incredibly important routes. And if the Israelis get a foothold in these straits that are very, very strategic for commerce in this area, this is extraordinarily dangerous for the stability of the region, because we know that obviously Israel has no principle. It is a terrorist regime, and it will do whatever it takes for its own interests, including destabilize entire regions just to get a foothold and a control of these very important strategic routes. So it's a very, very dangerous development, and it shows the depth of collaboration with the UAE, and also, again, the subservience of the UAE towards Israel. The question now is how far the UAE is willing to go, and why is it going this far? Because obviously, if we can understand, and I'm not in any way justifying the Sudanese decision, but if we can understand that economic uncertainty has pushed Sudan in this direction, there is no valid reason for the UAE to actually engage so closely with Israel, given that its economy is doing extraordinarily well. So there is something afoot going on here. It's very difficult to establish what the reason is, but absolutely, it is a very, very dangerous development for the stability of the region and for the African continent as well.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to end it there. Habzikar Mustafa, thank you for your input. Journalist and Middle East expert from London. And Netha Freeman, thank you, Pan-African Community Action Black Alliance for Peace from Washington, D.C. Thank you for your input. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakvay and the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
Fiqh or jurisprudence is an Islamic knowledge and is ranked
the Holy Prophet of Islam is the example
of
self-purification is the most significant
factor.
Imamate is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, welcome to another episode of Ulama Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Stay tuned. What does it mean when we say, trust in Allah? This phrase is also mentioned in the Holy Quran. Trust in Allah means to leave all of our affairs to Allah, the Creator, and to let Him to be in charge of solving our problems and difficulties. This means that we consider Allah as the sole decider for our destiny and no one else. It means to regard Allah as the only reformer of all the affairs in this world. You, as a Muslim, must remember Allah and no one else in your life. Trust in Allah also means being aware of the fact that Allah is the only entity that can solve your problems. The mere belief in this fact is also important. We must not expect others to find solution for our problems. This is the closest meaning of the phrase, trust in Allah. Thank you. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Ulama Speech, which was the English translation of a short speech by Ayatollah Nasiri. Please do log into our website, which is parsetoday.com. And if you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, send an email to englishradio@irib.ir. Until next time, God bless you all, and may Allah be with you.
خاکتو قرمز و سبز و سپید نمنم من نمن منم من ذره خاک وطنم من ذره خاک وطنم من ایران خاک دلیران ایران کنام شیران ایران همیشه جاویدان.
This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
New communications director Guto Harry walking into the Prime Minister's office carrying a bag of groceries. Another new face, Conservative MP Steve Barclay, now Boris Johnson's chief of staff, part of the Prime Minister's shake-up at number 10.
It's not actually driven by Boris. It's being driven by a faction that's trying to remove him. And the reason it's happening now is because we're at the mid-stage between general elections.
The new appointments come after five of the PM's most trusted Downing Street staff quit last week over Partygate allegations. And more changes are promised as he looks to turn the rising tide of letters of no confidence. Those letters follow allegations of parties held under the Prime Minister's roof during lockdown, when the rest of the people adhered to the strict social distancing guidelines. In total, 16 parties allegedly took place in 2 years of lockdowns. An inquiry conducted by civil servant Sue Gray, although published in its redacted form, only mentioned four of the parties, all of which pointed to a violation of the government's own rules. The other 12 are under investigation by the Metropolitan Police, who stepped in at the 11th hour, asking Sue Gray not to release her inquiry in full, buying the Prime Minister more time. Despite public outcry and the calls from members of his own party on him to resign, Boris Johnson and those closest to him say the country should move on from the scandal.
And this is an attempt actually to remove him, to put a Remainer or a globalist in charge for the next general election. That's what's really going on. I think Boris will stick the course and he'll probably be with us in 2024. And unless Labour finds someone better than Keir Starmer to stand against him in 2024, Boris is much more likely than Labour to win that general election in 2 years' time.
Yet other experts say that while he and his allies work in overdrive to shore up his future as prime minister, the fallout from the Sue Gray inquiry and the ongoing Metropolitan Police investigation hangs over Boris Johnson's head like a Damocles sword. Site for is up, London.
Advocates and families of Palestinian prisoners have protested at the Red Cross office in the besieged Gaza Strip in solidarity with thousands of Palestinian inmates languishing inside Israeli jails. They protested Israel's inhumane treatment of Palestinian political prisoners. According to the Commission of Detainees and Ex-Detainees Affairs, hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are suffering from medical negligence.
Israel is practicing systematic medical negligence against Palestinian prisoners. Currently, more than 700 prisoners are suffering from chronic illnesses and are denied proper medical care. Palestinian prisoners also must not be treated inside military hospitals.
Hundreds of Palestinians are also being held in Israeli jails without charge or trial under the so-called administrative detention, where incarceration periods can be renewed indefinitely. During a press conference outside the Red Cross office, the Islamic Jihad movement slammed the inhumane Israeli policy of administrative detention.
As we stand here, we affirm our support for Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails, especially those held under administrative detention. They have been refusing to attend courts for 38 days now, because administrative detention is illegal and is a crime against Palestinians.
Palestinian prisoners are denied basic human rights and continue to languish behind bars as Tel Aviv continues to violate international laws and norms regarding the treatment of prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails are prisoners of war, and they must be treated according to international law and norms. Because we are under occupation, Palestinian prisoners need international protection, and Israel must be held accountable for its crimes against the prisoners.
Palestinian prisoners also suffer from prolonged solitary confinement and inhumane detention conditions.
Latest figures by human rights groups show that the Israeli regime has arrested over 1 million Palestinians since 1967, including women and children. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Iran and Kashmir have a long history of cultural, linguistic and ethnic ties dating back to pre-Islamic period. The arrival of great Iranian religious missionaries in Kashmir, particularly in the 14th and 15th century, cemented this bond further. The overwhelming Iranian influence in Kashmir earned the Himalayan region the sobriquet of Iran-e-Saghir, or Little Iran. In February 1979, following the victory of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Kashmir was among the first to wholeheartedly embrace it. They rejoiced at Iran's liberation from the clutches of the US-backed Pahlavi regime.
I remember when the news of triumph of Islamic Revolution reached here, people of all shades took to the streets in jubilation. Rallies and gatherings were held. Soon after the victory of Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei visited Kashmir, followed by the other prominent revolutionary figures like Mahdavi Ghani and Golzadeh Ghafuri. The bond between Iran and Kashmir has only grown stronger over the years.
People were very minutely and very carefully watching the Iran Revolution at that time. And for a few reasons, Kashmir has been, you know, historically connected with Iran and Central Asia. There was a propagation of Islam here and a lot of people converting to the faith of Islam as a result of Mir Sayyid Ali Hamdani. Hamdani brought economic pursuits like, say, binding industry paper and binding industry at that time, 550 years back. And along with traditional handicrafts, which were, you know, flourishing at that time in Iran, he brought certain artisans, certain craftsmen, skilled people, and they came along with the propagation of faith.
Political observers and academics in this Muslim-majority region believe the Islamic Revolution's core message of Islamic unity and anti-imperialism struck a chord with people in Kashmir. They derived inspiration from it in their quest for freedom, justice and equality.
people of Kashmir saw it positively. They cooperated with it because there was already a prevailing atmosphere of Muslim unity in Kashmir those days. They joined the gatherings which were celebrated in connection with the celebration of Islamic Revolution and as a message for Islamic unity and the upliftment of the downtrodden peoples of the world.
As the world marks the 43rd anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, people here in Kashmir take immense pride in being the advocates of this great movement that has championed the cause of Islamic revival and resistance against the arrogant powers of the world. Sayyidri Safir, Indian administered Kashmir.
Iranians celebrate the 43rd anniversary of the Islamic Revolution that transformed their country from a U.S. ally to a bitter opponent. Yemenis are still facing a deadly U.S.-backed war. This has urged Yemeni politicians to try to learn more about the Islamic Revolution and its stance against U.S. hegemony.
The region was about to fall prey to the American Zionist project, and the Arab regimes would have given up on the Palestinian cause, resulting in the further oppression of the Palestinians and the deterioration of the Arabs' dream of liberation from American hegemony. The Islamic Revolution turned Iran into the first country to be freed from U.S. dependence. It created a psychological balance among the people. As for the Arab puppet regimes, they feared the danger of the people and delayed their normalization with the Zionists. Today, Muslims are aware of U.S. dominating policies and find liberation necessary.
Yemeni politicians and scholars say the Islamic Revolution keeps on inspiring Yemeni people to stand against the U.S. and its supported forces in the region, just as they did on their September 21st revolution 8 years ago.
I still remember the outbreak of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. I was studying in secondary school and Arab people were constantly talking about it. We even wore t-shirts with the image of Imam Khomeini. But given the importance of this revolution, many Arab dictators started to ban the clothes that had the image of Imam Khomeini on them. And this is one of the first memories that they have of the Islamic Revolution. The Yemeni people have learned a lot from the Islamic Revolution in Iran. It encouraged them to stand against the colonial policies in their own country. And this also sparked their revolution of September 21st, 2014.
Since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, Iran has always been a strong supporter of the Palestinian cause and has marked the International Quds Day, and now it is also standing beside the people of Yemen in the U.S.-backed Saudi-led war against them.
Observers say all the free people of the world must look up to the Islamic Revolution of Iran and follow in the footsteps of its leaders in order to stand against the U.S. hegemony. They say the Islamic Revolution will remain a source of pride for all Yemenis. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
While Iran is marking the anniversary of its 1979 revolution, which overthrew a U.S.-backed regime, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank hail it as the most successful revolution in the contemporary era. I met the former speaker of the Palestinian Legislative Council, Dr. Hassan Khreshi. He praised the Iranian revolution as a source of inspiration in the region and beyond. After the 1979 revolution, Iran started supporting the Palestinians. It all began after Iranians took over the Israeli embassy in Tehran and handed it over to the Palestine Liberation Organization. As part of its effort to inspire the oppressed people, Iran aided emerging Palestinian resistance groups, notably the movements of Islamic Jihad and Hamas. Both the Palestinian factions sent their representatives to Tehran, while Iran's support for both groups continue until today. Iran's Islamic Revolution was led by Imam Khomeini. The revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments. To Palestinians, the revolution anniversary is reminiscent of their struggle for independence and resistance against the Israeli atrocities.
Iran's Islamic Revolution is viewed today as a potent, unstoppable force in the region and beyond. An example in this regard is the heroic struggles of the Palestinian people against Israel. Mona Qandil, Occupy Ramallah.
Racist system!
U.S. police violence targeting black people has once again brought Americans to the streets in the northern city of Minneapolis, which is still reeling from the police murder of George Floyd, a black man, in 2020. This time, the victim is Amir Locke, a 22-year-old African-American who was killed when police stormed into his apartment without warning on Wednesday. Hundreds of protesters rallied in the city, calling for the arrest of officers involved in the shooting and an end to discriminatory law enforcement tactics. Similar protests were held in New York City. The officers were carrying out a no-knock search warrant on the apartment. The city's mayor has now announced a suspension of no-knock warrants that have been at the center of heated debates over rising police violence. Back in 2020, the city restricted the use of such unannounced raids as part of a series of reforms that were introduced following mass anti-racism protests.
They barge in before they ever identify themselves, and they give Amir no time to save his own life. And that's something that we don't see white citizens encounter. And the fact that it's happening in Minneapolis again is beyond tragic, it's abhorrent.
Locke's parents say their son was a beloved member of his community and a law-abiding citizen.
I believe that he was executed by the MPD, and I want the police officer that murdered my son to be prosecuted and fired.
Locke's death has reopened the wounds caused by the murder of Floyd and a dozen of other recent victims. Official figures show that black men are three times more likely than white men to be killed by police during their lifetime. But police bullets, batons, or knees are not the only concerns to African Americans. The deep-rooted anti-black racism also shows itself in inadequate access to health care, food, housing, and jobs. In 2020, the injustices long felt by African Americans triggered a nationwide protest movement challenging police brutality and bias in the U.S. criminal justice system. And that movement transformed into a global campaign to fight racism and build a world free of discrimination and supremacist ideologies.
Israel once again at the heart of an international rift and controversy, this time within a usually united body valuing consensus, the African Union. A row so fierce that the bloc was forced to suspend a debate on whether to rescind Israel's observer status and postpone a potentially divisive vote. The rare dispute within the 55-member body was set in motion last July. That's when Moussa Faki Mahamat, the chairman of the African Union Commission, unilaterally accepted Israel's accreditation to the bloc. A slew of criticism followed. Powerful members, including South Africa and Algeria, were among the many protesting that the decision had been taken without consultations. They also argued that the decision flew in the face of African Union statements supporting the Palestinian territories. The AU has called for an end to the Israeli occupation and an independent Palestinian state, with East Al-Quds as its capital. Israel received AU observer status after 20 years of diplomatic efforts. The quest is largely seen as part of the regime's US-backed campaign to normalize ties with African and Arab countries such as Morocco, Sudan, the UAE and Bahrain. But analysts believe the normalization does not enjoy popular support.
Of course, Israel has hitherto been, of course, unaccepted in Asia or in West Asia. And although you've got clandestinely nations like Saudi Arabia who have been dealing with it and others more overtly like Jordan and Egypt, etc., you've nonetheless got this kind of fear amongst leaderships in West Asia, even now, of openly becoming part of the Israeli syndicate, because the people, ultimately at the grassroots, certainly the Arab people, are not happy with the idea of Israel being accepted.
Palestine gained observer status at the African Union in 2013. Its Prime Minister, Mohamed Shtaya, addressed the bloc's latest summit held at the weekend. He called for Israel's accreditation to be revoked.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion. This must stop.
Resistance movement Hamas has also slammed granting Israel the observer status. Hamas says the move is a flagrant violation of the principles and statute of the African Union, which reject racism and demand decolonization and the right to self-determination. The African body has now set up a six-country committee to review Israel's observer status and submit its findings during an assembly next year, a decision that will ultimately come down to whether or not the bloc will stick to its anti-colonial and anti-racist principles.
When the Iranian Islamic Revolution took place in 1979, prominent Nigerian Islamic cleric Sheikh Ibrahim Al-Zazaki was a young university student preaching against immorality. He says that the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran and the leader of the revolution, Imam Khomeini, were sources of inspiration to many young Nigerians.
It makes us, you know, it boosts our morale and it makes us feel that what we have been yearning and aspiring is realizable, is possible since it has been realized elsewhere. You know, the success of the revolution was, a turning point in modern history.
Professor Sadiq Abba was also a young student who cared about the common good for all Nigerians and said that the Islamic Revolution was based on knowledge and the collective willpower on the Iranian people.
The Iranian Revolution is a revolution that sprang up to address global injustice, global inequalities, and global socioeconomic exploitation and expropriations by the Western world.
Dr. Imam Mukhtar says the 1979 Islamic Revolution was a change that was inspired by Iranians who have had enough.
It was a unique revolution that was led and driven by individuals, groups, young people and old alike, who saw a frustration with the system, which was with the Shah regime, which was not only pro-West, but then subduing the people within the domestic environment. And it was a collective responsibility.
Experts believe that one of the significant outcomes of the 1979 Islamic Revolution was turning Iran into a power in the Middle East region with even influence in global affairs. Danjum Abdullahi, Abuja.
When Saudi Arabia launched an air campaign on Yemen in March 2015, it assured the U.S. administration of President Barack Obama that it would oust the Ansarullah movement within months. But the war, aimed at restoring a former friendly government in the Yemeni capital Sana'a, dragged on with limited military gains. Under Obama, whose government had close bonds with Saudi Arabia, indiscriminate and disproportionate airstrikes continued on Yemen. Homes, markets, schools, hospitals, weddings, and funerals were targeted with U.S.-made weapons, including widely banned cluster munitions. An all-out Saudi blockade exacerbated Yemen's health and nutrition crises, and diseases like cholera began to spread like wildfire. And all those happened amid military and diplomatic support provided by the Obama administration. The U.S. also stood silent in 2016 when Saudi Arabia, through threats of cutting funds to the UN, finally forced the world body to drop it from its list of the worst offenders against children for its attacks on Yemeni kids. Obama lost all chances to stop the slaughter. Donald Trump followed in the footsteps of his predecessor in supporting Saudi Arabia and made his first trip as U.S. president to the Arab Kingdom. Hours after landing in the Saudi capital Riyadh on the 20th of May 2017, Trump sealed a $350 billion arms deal with King Salman, the largest in world history. The transaction included tanks, combat ships, missile defense systems, as well as radar, communications, and cybersecurity technology. 2 years later, the U.S. president vetoed a bipartisan resolution to force stop America's involvement in Yemen's bloodshed. Like Obama, Trump, too, missed all the chances to end the slaughter.
This war has to end.
That's what incumbent Joe Biden said last year, just weeks into his presidency, announcing an end to U.S. assistance for Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen, as well as relevant arms sales. However, months later, that promise was broken as his government approved two arms deals worth over $1 billion. To support the United Arab Emirates against Yemen's retaliatory attacks, the U.S. is now deploying a destroyer and fighter jets in the UAE, a key member of the Saudi-led military coalition. France also says it will give military support to the UAE to help it protect its airspace. The Biden administration is also planning to bring Yemen's Ansarullah movement back on a U.S. blacklist. Aid organizations warn that the move would prevent the delivery of critical humanitarian assistance to millions of innocent people and could have adverse humanitarian consequences.
It will have much effect on Yemeni civilians because many UN agency and NGOs are working in Yemen. If the United States will continue or if they will declare the Houthi as a terrorist group, this will have a huge and a bad effect on Yemeni civilians.
By sticking to warmongering policies, the current U.S. president is also missing on his chances to stop the war, a conflict that the UN says has already turned Yemen into the largest humanitarian crisis in the world.
In the limelight.
With the publication of Amnesty International's new apartheid report, the Zionist regime supporters have just one tactic left: to accuse critics of anti-Semitism, says Jonathan Cook, journalist, in an article titled Amnesty Apartheid Report: The Walls Protecting the Israeli Regime Are Finally Crumbling. Stay tuned for more. The walls protecting the Zionist regime are quickly crumbling. A year ago, it was the Zionist regime's most celebrated human rights group, B'Tselem. Month later, it was the New York-based Human Rights Watch, whose senior staff have often enjoyed a revolving door with the U.S. State Department. Now, the one speaking up is Amnesty International, an organization widely viewed as the most authoritative arbiter of what constitutes human rights violations. Over the past year, all have reached the same conclusion. The Zionist regime is an apartheid regime. According to Amnesty's new report published recently, Israel's system of institutionalized segregation and discrimination against Palestinians as a racial group in all areas under its control amounts to a system of apartheid. This is not just a criticism of the Zionist regime's occupation. All three groups have been pointing out for decades the Zionist regime's flagrant disregard of international law and its likely commission of war crimes in the occupied territories. But the Zionist regime was little concerned, so as public debate was confined to the occupation. Its advocates quickly learned that they could always deflect to matters of the Zionist regime's security by presenting any Palestinian resistance as terrorism. Now the consensus is shifting to entirely new terrain. a discursive battlefield where the Zionist regime has less effective weapons with which to defend itself. The biggest human rights watchdogs are agreed that everything about the Zionist regime's rule over Palestinians is connected, from its military oppression of those under occupation to the civil legal system inside the occupied territories that systematically confers inferior rights on the large minority of nominal Palestinian citizens. In other words, the Zionist regime's apartheid structures cannot be disentangled, separating out the occupied territories from Israel proper. It is all part of the same single system of rule by one ethnic national group, Jews, designed to oppress and marginalize another ethnic national group, Palestinians. Late in the day, the champions of human rights have fully understood that the divisions between the Zionist regime and occupied territories are simply cosmetic.